Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today on screens across the country, one of the late summer releases comes out. The movie is Julie and Julia. It's a heartwarming story about a young woman who decides on a life project for a year that has to do with cooking through all 544 recipes in Julia Child's famed Mastering the Art of French Cooking in 365 days. It is really a very heartwarming movie. My wife and I saw it last night, and it's one of those movies that causes you to say, yeah, you know, cooking's really important. I'm hungry after seeing that, because it's about a celebration of food. It's about more than that. But in response to the release of that movie, Michael Pollan wrote a cover story for the New York Times Magazine, and here's the thrust of that. People are fascinated with food on television like never before. Here you have food on the big screen with Julie and Julia. There is a food network. There are competitive chef shows on television. But Americans are actually cooking less and less. As a matter of fact, this is one of those things should get your attention right away. Americans are actually spending a good deal more time watching television about cooking than cooking. The average household now has only about 27 minutes of cooking a day. 27 minutes. That's an incredible statistic right there. I wrote an article at my website at albertmohler.com on the cooking creature. We're going to talk about why I use those words. And recovering a lost wisdom. I have had a phenomenal response by email and other digital sources. I want to hear from you now. I'd really like to hear from a lot of you out there who say, you know, this is where cooking fits in the life. Because from a Christian worldview perspective, it's not just a hobby. It's not just a project. It's about something more seriously directed at what it means to be human and to be a human creature. The only creature, by the way, that cooks. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I have a very special treat coming up. My wife, Mary, and daughter, Katie, are here in the studio with me. We're going to have a fun conversation. And it's one that I think just about every single individual and family can connect to. We're going to get to that in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news. The big news is that, of course, both houses of the United States Congress have gone on a summer break. This comes every year, but it comes this year at a very strategic time. As the impetus towards a health insurance or health care reform piece of legislation has really hit the rocks. A lot of coverage on this, and as a matter of fact, if you've been looking at the major newspapers, if you've been listening to the major news channels, you've been hearing a steady drumbeat. And there are basically two different positions taken on the future of health care. I'm not going to get into the politics or the policies of it right now. I'm simply going to say that what you hear from many people is that this means that democracy isn't working. It's this hard, you hear people saying, to get major legislation through. It's too hard. Well, this is democracy at work. Folks, this is the way it's supposed to be. If we were in Great Britain with a parliamentary democracy, the majority party would just get their policies through on a simple party vote because that's the way that system works. That is not the way the American system of democracy works. That's why we have a system of checks and balances. That's why, at the end of the day, having a two-party system really does shape a democracy. And right now, by the way, the biggest obstacle to President Obama getting his health insurance reform policies through is not the Republican Party, but the Blue Dog Democrats within his own party. I just want to celebrate for a moment what this means for America, because without regard right now, because I am no prophet, to exactly what's going to come out of this legislative debate, this much is clear. It isn't going to be exactly what anyone wanted. It isn't going to be what this administration wanted. And by the way, this administration still has not landed on a specific proposal legislatively that can be voted up or down. It's in constant negotiation right now. And even as you hear many people saying, this is democracy breaking down. No, it isn't. This is democracy working. This is the way it's supposed to work. And especially as the senators and representatives go back to their home districts and home states, they're going to be hearing from an awful lot of citizens. And folks, that's the way democracy works. This gives you the opportunity right now to communicate by email, by snail mail, by writing cards and letters, by phone calls, and in every other way, you have the opportunity to get to your congressperson. You have the opportunity to get to your United States senators and let them know what you think about this. And if you think it's simply taking too much time, consider the scale and magnitude of this legislation and be very, very thankful that we're not in a system of government where it just gets pushed through in a hurry. This is something that ought to take a good deal of legislative attention, and it ought to take some time. I do want to raise one policy issue related to the debate about health care right now. The current policies that are in the proposal presented by the majority party, the Democratic Party, would, I am firmly convinced, and now we have good documentation to support this, we're really looking at abortion being included within the coverage. And that is something that ought to have the attention of every single concerned Christian. This would put the United States government and every single taxpayer in the position of subsidizing abortion coverage. And when you think about what that would mean, you realize, again, that it's a good thing this legislation is not yet passed. It's a good thing that this debate continues, and it would be a very lamentable thing in the extreme if this legislation were to get through, putting the United States taxpayers in the position of underwriting the killing of the unborn. We'll be tracking that very carefully as we move forward. Very interesting news story that came in the form of an obituary in the New York Times. The death is that of Yuri Verlinsky, age 65, an expert in embryonic screening, a Russian immigrant who came to the United States, died in Chicago on June the 16th. This is a late obit published in the New York Times. The reason the New York Times published the obituary is because he is believed to be the single scientist who probably did more than any other to develop pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. That's PGD. We've talked about this on the program. This is a medical technology, a reproductive technology, that means that embryos are screened for genetic defects so that only those embryos free of such defects are transferred into the mother's womb. Now, what I want to note as I'm looking at this obituary is not so much the man and what he did, but the way the New York Times explains this. There is, for instance, a scare quote. That's the larger text found in the article. This is what it says. A scientist who helped patients conceive healthy babies. Then you have statements made, for instance, one by Dr. Andrew LaBarbera of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. He said this, Verlinsky was a giant in the field because he transformed PGD into a routine procedure that has, listen to these words, enabled innumerable couples to conceive children free of genetic disease. He made it available to clinics around the world. Repeatedly in this article, it says that he helped patients conceive healthy babies. Folks, what he helped to do is to eliminate embryos that were considered substandard. Not one embryo was therapeutically helped to be more healthy. Only embryos that were considered unacceptable were destroyed. I think it is very illuminating to see how the media treats this. I think when the New York Times writes an obituary about a scientist like this and describes his work simply in terms of helping patients conceive healthy babies, we're right in George Orwell's territory. We're here missing the obvious. This is a man who developed a technology that allows a search and destroy mission on human embryos. Another story is coming out of Great Britain. It turns out that those who have been pushing for the legalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide in Great Britain have taken great steps forward because many now believe that Britain is moving much closer towards assisted suicide. Debbie Purdy, who suffers from multiple sclerosis, won a landmark ruling in the House of Lords just recently. She did so very interestingly. She went to the House of Lords and she said, "What would the ultimate charge be against my husband if he were to assist me in committing suicide?" In this case, by taking her to the Dignitas Euthanasia Clinic in Switzerland. That's a very, very chilling development. And it shows you what's going on. It's really been in almost all the major European countries and in Great Britain for some time. But in Great Britain, this is a quantum leap forward because the ruling she got was that the maximum, her husband would not be held for murder, but for some far lesser charge. There are those who are saying, well, if that's the case, then it must not be that morally significant, and there should be no criminalization, no charge whatsoever. We'll be watching that one carefully as well. One interesting thing to note in terms of this economic downturn is that it has had a disproportionate effect upon men. And this has been noted again and again. The labor statistics bear this out, report after report. The persons most likely to have lost jobs in this economic downturn are those who are in male-dominated professions. There is one alternative part of this picture, though. The New York Times is out with another report showing that there is one field of endeavor in which there have been very few cutbacks, and those are repairmen. It turns out that if you know how to handle tools, you know how to fix broken pipes or toilets that won't flush, air conditioners that won't run, refrigerators that are getting hot, it turns out if you have those skills, you just might have a job. Because at the end of the day, everybody needs to have those things fixed. That's a testimony, I think, to the continuing importance of labor and why knowing how to fix things never goes out of style. The same should be true of cooking. Passing down the culinary wisdom from generation to generation is not just about cooking. It's about family tradition. It's about love and care and hospitality and about a whole lot more we'll be talking about when we come right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Eating is such an important part of what it means to be human. You know, our need for food is a reminder of our finitude. The human creature needs food. Every creature needs food. All animals need food, and that's just a reminder of the fact that we are finite, we are limited, we are needy. And if we ever forget our neediness, we're going to be reminded of that by our appetite, our need for food, very, very quickly. But, you know, even as other animals also eat, cows graze, even predators go after their prey, we're the only animal that cooks. James Boswell, writing in The Age of Enlightenment, referred to human beings as the cooking animal. Homo sapiens is the animal that cooks, and the distinctive hallmark, he argued, of what it means to be human is to cook. Now, I think there's far more than that, but there's not less than that. The movie Julie and Julia comes out tonight, released on a multitude of screens across the country. It's a big release. It's expected, perhaps, to be the top-grossing late-summer release. It's a heartwarming story, and my wife and I and daughter saw the movie last night in preparation for some conversation here on the air. And even though this is not about the movie does kind of spark a cultural conversation about cooking. And it's not the conversation that those involved in the movie might expect. I think Michael Pollan, writing in the New York Times Magazine, really gets to the heart of the issue when he says, something's going on here that's very strange. Americans are fascinated with cooking. They're just not doing it. They're buying these expansive homes with expansive kitchens and up-to-date culinary instruments. They're buying all kinds of appliances. They're watching the Food Network and competitive chef cook-offs. But here's a statistic that really arrested my attention. Americans are actually spending now more time watching cooking on television than they are actually cooking, down to about 27 minutes a day preparation time cooking. And by the way, Michael Pollan also makes the point that much of what is called cooking today isn't actually cooking. It's not actually taking materials and putting them together and cooking. It's pushing a button. Putting something already prepared, the reign of processed food. There is so much going on here. But I have here in the studio with me two very special people, my wife Mary and daughter Katie. And when I thought of this whole issue of cooking, I tell you what, I read this article with a great deal of gratitude. And I'm going to make that gratitude very specific. My wife is a phenomenal cook. And she's not a phenomenal cook just out of the blue. She is the daughter of a phenomenal cook. And she has taught our daughter how to cook. And there is a passing down of knowledge here I think is very important. I think as Christians there's something very important here, because what we're talking about is a wisdom that's about more than food. It's about love that is manifested in the task of preparing, cooking, presenting food. I want you to join the conversation. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We have some callers on the line. We'll get to those calls in just a moment. But I want to turn to Mary for just a moment and say, you know, when you think of cooking, where did your imagination about cooking first begin? I mean, where did you first think, I'm going to cook?
Well, clearly some of my earliest memories would be in our own kitchen at home watching my mother cook. And that was the norm, you know, toys that little girls are given and that they use from the earliest stages relate to playing house, you know, having your little play kitchen and and those types of implements. It was just very natural and something I had an interest in from the very beginning.
Now, Michael Pollan makes a very interesting point in his article about both boys and girls, about the fact that the baby boomer generation, our generation, by and large, we grew up watching our moms do magic in the kitchen. And it was a large part of their day. It took up a great deal of their time. Getting the food, preparing the food, washing the food, cutting it up, just doing all the things you have to do until it finally gets on the table. And like Michael Pollan, I have to tell you, as a little boy, I thought of that as almost magic. You know, here is something raw, and it ends up on the table, delicious to eat.
That's true, but, you know, we're just not seeing that as the norm anymore. And I think there's several things at play here that cause that to be the case. One, I think you've got a group of women, and we don't see a whole lot of these personally, but they're out there. But they wear it as a badge of honor. You know, they're proud of the fact, I don't cook. I don't boil water. I don't own a cookbook or an apron. And, you know, I don't want to. I've got a fancy oven. I don't know how to use it. Because I look at that as a menial task that's beneath my dignity. My time spent better doing something else. And so they still have to eat, as you said. So they either eat out, they hire cooks. They've got a nanny that cooks for the children if they have children. They're clearly not teaching their own daughters to cook. And if their daughters grow up and put on an apron and go out into the marketplace to be a chef somewhere, they would applaud that. But if those same daughters want to go home and be in a home atmosphere where they're cooking for a husband and children, then those women would look on that with disapproval. I think you've got another group of women who look at those of us who do enjoy cooking and have meal preparation and have a lot of fun around the family table, and they kind of see that with a little bit of a smirk as, you know, that's cute. I'm glad they enjoy that. They have fun. That's a little bit kind of leave it to beaverish for me, they think. You know, this is 2009. You really don't have to work at it that hard anymore. Plus, we're busy. Our kids are doing this, that, the other. To be honest, we don't even sit down for a family meal that often. And so, you know, they're also not teaching their daughters to cook. They've relegated food to something that's really not worth talking about that much.
Well, you're making the point that it's part of a bigger picture. I mean, right. First of all, we've alienated ourselves from where food comes from. You know, we don't live on farms anymore. So our kids don't grow up making a connection of egg to chicken to drumstick. And now we've alienated ourselves from the preparation of food. And so, an awful lot of kids just must assume that food comes from a freezer. And you know, you stick it in, you push a button, that's cooking. One of the points that comes up in the literature about this, and I think Michael Pollan and other writers are doing a great job about this, even documenting these transformations, is how that, for instance, pre-prepared foods and processed foods, in many cases, aren't even really good for you.
That's true. That's true. And you're looking at children who are growing up, and I think you see a lot of picky eaters coming out of this because you've got children who are used to chicken fingers and French fries and pizza and hamburgers. They've never seen half of the vegetables that you know, our own children have seen. Therefore, a lot of them just assume if it's green, I don't like it. They've just never been exposed to it. There's a whole avenue you can go down here that you don't have to worry about manners if you're eating out of a take-home, you know, carton. You're not worrying about what fork to use or setting tables or even the accountability of FaceTime and eye contact with your children around a family table. I mean, there's a whole realm of things here that come into play.
You know, I've written an article, and we've done programs on the fact that families that have dinner together around a table are going to have children that statistically can be proved to have greater grade point averages, fewer detentions, and fewer all kinds of pathologies that we're concerned about with children and adolescents. There's something about the table, something about eating, and I think as a Christian believer, we need to understand that God gave us the gift of food, not merely so that we would have our hunger satisfied, but so that we would have to do things giving priority to food that would bring us together. And I lament the loss of that. You know, in my article published today at albertmiller.com on the cooking creature recovering a lost wisdom, I tell an anecdote, not about to embarrass the student, but I had a student who was driving me one day, and just along the way, he asked a very innocent question. He turned to me and he said, "Dr. Moeller, how long were you married before Mrs. Moeller became a good cook?" Literally, the way he put it was, until she got good at it. And you know, I'll just tell you the truth, I've never known a time when my wife wasn't good at it. And as much as I want to honor her with that, I also want to honor her mother with that. I've never known a time when food is not being prepared for me in the home with my mother and grandmothers, and then especially for the larger portion of my life with the dedication of my wife, who demonstrates pleasure in what she does for her family and love as well. We'll be back with Mary and with Katie in just a moment, and with your calls. We've got a host of callers ready to talk. We're going to get to those right when we come back. The phone number is 877-893-8255. We want to hear from you as well, coast to coast and with listeners around the world. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Listening to the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmueller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK to join the conversation. We're going to go first to San Diego, California. John's on the line. Go ahead, John.
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I was hearing you mention Boswell and that humans are the cooking creature. Well, in town, I'm sort of known as the cooking preacher. And we use cooking classes as a part of encouraging hospitality in our church, and we also use it as an outreach. We invite people from the community, and we have 30 to 50 people a lot of times for these cooking classes. So it's a need that's out there, and people are hungry for it.
You know, I think there's something very interesting in the point about the universality of food as an interest. And by the way, you know, when we, as speaking of the Baptist tradition, we get together, we generally say where there are two or three Baptists gathered, there's probably a meal on the way. And it's very interesting when you start looking at other faith traditions, you see a very similar thing. You know, there's a Jewish tradition of cooking, very warm-hearted, very, very, long and ancient in its traditions. And by the way, all these things have been coming kind of infused in. You know, we now share each other's food. There are all these traditions. There's a Catholic fish fries, and you've got all this coming up because food is something that brings us together, and the together is the opportunity. And John, as you can use cooking as a way to reach people for the gospel of Lord Jesus Christ, then cook away. I think that's great because it by the way transitions from one need to a far deeper need. The need for food transition to the need for the gospel. Let's go to Nancy calling from Hendersonville, North Carolina. What do you think, Nancy?
Hi, Dr. Mueller. I was just calling, and I haven't really, actually your radio show isn't playing where I am right now, but I was calling in favor of cooking as a family. We've got six teenagers at home, and we use cooking a lot of times as a family activity. We'll spend hours making things from scratch and working together and, you know, enjoying the meal together. So it's been a really valuable thing for our family.
You know, I have to tell you, Nancy, I love your call. And I know there are an awful lot of moms out there going, six teenagers. My goodness, cooking just for six teenagers must be an incredible thing. But I think it's great how you're involving them together and passing down wisdom. And I think that passing down of wisdom is so very important because it's a passing down of more than knowledge. It's a passing down of relationship that takes place in the context of the preparation of food. I've had some interesting responses, by the way, to my article. Some have accused me of being sexist, and I'm just going to say, look, if anyone here thinks that the majority of cooking is going to be done by men rather than women, then you're probably, well, you can call and make your point. It's just not going to happen. And I think that even as there's no restriction of cooking to women, and it's great for men to cook, and in professional cooking fields, and many of them are actually male-dominated, there's no embarrassment about a man cooking. The reality is that in the normal ordering of the home, it's the woman and it is women and their daughters who are going to end up being the stewards of cooking. I think there's absolutely no real doubt about that. I think it's a gift that is given by those who prepare the food to others. You know, one of the things that comes down in this consideration is cost-benefit analysis. You know, it's a time saver to get processed food, but it often is not a money saver. There are all kinds of things going on here. Just a few nights ago, Mary and Katie, our daughter and I, ended up looking through a cookbook. The cookbook was actually a family cookbook from my wife's father's family, several generations passed it down. It's a great project. It's in called the Meyer Family Cookbook. It really originates from Nebraska, a farm family there in Nebraska where Mary's dad, the late Marvin Kaler, grew up. And it goes back several generations. And so there we were just looking through recipe after recipe. And we were getting an education in food, but also an education in family, because following through all these names and the relationships was something really important. I was touched by something that night, and I'm going to turn to Mary and say, Mary, I was really touched by the fact that you were so intent on finding recipes from your grandmother.
I certainly was. My grandmother was deceased when I was 6 months old, never had the privilege of meeting her, but I was just scouring through that cookbook hoping to find a recipe that I could hang my hat on, really, and use and claim as her recipe. I just think the importance of passing down that tradition would be very, very special. And I did find one, so that was a good thing.
You know, I just thought that was really sweet. It touched my heart because here was a granddaughter with a great-granddaughter right beside her looking for a tie to a grandmother, feeling like if I have one of her recipes, I'll have a tie to her. You know, folks, how many of your descendants are going to have a tie to you through what they eat when they remember how you loved your family by what you cooked? The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We'll be back to talk on the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. This is a warm-hearted discussion about food because of how central food is to our lives in terms of our everyday existence and what hospitality means and what cooking means, the preparation of food and culinary knowledge, tradition, wisdom passed down from generation to generation. Here in the studio with me is my wife, Mary, and also our daughter, Katie, who is 20. And Katie, let me just ask you a point-blank question. You know, what is the state of cooking in your generation?
I think the state of cooking in my generation could be defined as, you know, we really don't, as college students that I encounter don't, or it's rare if they do. And that's not necessarily because they're disinterested in cooking. It could be a variety of reasons. But I know several girls, maybe they just weren't taught by their mothers because they weren't interested in middle and high school and their mothers didn't press it. Or maybe their mothers couldn't teach them because they didn't know how because they weren't trained by their mothers. And
Now, I know that you've done some cooking on campus, and you don't have any trouble drawing a crowd when you cook.
Well, maybe. That's what we have. We're blessed to have full kitchens in my dorms, so we are able to make dinner as roommates, or a lot of times I like to cook for my roommates or for different events and things, so it's definitely, I'm thankful that I had a mother who cared enough to train me, and even though it may have been easier for her to just do it herself, she could do it better and faster than I could, that she took the time to slow it down and show me how to do it, so not only did I know how to do it, but I'd done it right there alongside her, which gives me real confidence going forward to do that on my own, and Lord willing, with a daughter of my own one day.
You know, Mary, you teach hospitality in the Seminary Wise Institute and other things here. And, you know, one of the things that I've always thought, I have to say this with a smile because I always kind of enjoy seeing this happen. You've taught, I don't know how many women, for instance, how to make a pie crust.
This is true. And every time I throw that out there, I feel like, now they're going to think this is ridiculous. Who does this? You can buy them in the dairy case. But every time I have people sign up.
You have a full class every
time. It's a completely optional part of the class. And so we go and we, you know, we make pie crusts. We get our hands dirty and we do it. And it's fun to see these girls come and they've got all the equipment they got as wedding gifts, most of them, and they've just never had the need to try it out before, and so their husbands are very pleased with the results of that. It's funny though, also in the class I'll have people who will I'll never forget one years ago who looked at me and said, I'm so glad that this part of the hospitality class is here about meal planning. She said, my husband's been really patient, but she said, we're having spaghetti 3 and 4 times a week because that's the only thing I know how to make that isn't out of a box. And so, you know, and I looked at her probably with a look of, oh, my goodness, you've got to be the only person on the planet who feels that way. But in each class, it turns out there's a couple Stephanies who are like that, who have the desire, but for reasons like Katie stated, you know, just never acquired the skills. And so it's fun to walk those ladies through that and then to see the results.
So how do you overcome this? I mean, if someone comes at you and says, all right, Mary, we got a problem. We have this lost wisdom. How is it recovered? What would you say?
I say you start simply and you sit down with your husband and your kids if they're old enough and you say, look, what meals would you like to be able to have that we can easily prepare? And you'll come up with 5 or 10 things right off the bat. And then you just, you know, you keep it simple. You gain confidence in preparing those meals. Then you're able to add to it. You know, if your mom is around still and now you do have the time to be able to learn from her, great. Many mother-in-laws are willing to help and step in that role. But there's a lot of local church women who don't want to stand up and teach a class, but who would be glad to have someone come into their home, into their kitchen and say, look, here's what we do. Here's how we make a shopping list. We use a categorized list. We walk into the store. People are even intimidated by going into the grocery store, I've found. They don't, you know, do I buy green beans? Do I get canned ones, frozen ones, fresh ones? I don't know. There's so many options here. And so you start simple and you gain confidence. There's some great books out there. One that's a great title is Where's Mom Now That I Need Her? And that's a common gift that people are given, and that's literally, it's a cookbook with a frying pan with smoke coming out of it. And it's like, where is she now that I need her? The Absolute Beginner's Cookbook, subtitled, How Long Do I Cook a 3-Minute Egg? Because there are people who just, they just need, you know, to start at the beginning. And so you do that, and you don't beat yourself up about the fact that it's not all from scratch or that it's not something that would be featured on a Cooking Network show. But it's to feed your family. It's to show your love and really your interest in providing for them nutritious meals. We're not talking about, some people, you know, equate home cooking with, you know, macaroni and cheese, fried chicken, and all these fat-laden things. It's really much more than talking about the food itself, but it's also just talking about nutritious, economical, fresh ingredients that you can use to make food for your family. And so I also have to add that, you know, it's a special act of love to prepare somebody's comfort food for them. And your sweet mother wrote down recipes I still have in her own handwriting where she gave them to me, because even though I enjoy cooking, you know, my style of cooking is a different style than from what you were raised with, and I certainly wanted you to be happy. And so she wrote those out for me, and I've continued to use those. And as you said, you were blessed with a mother who enjoyed cooking as well. I had a student who did that as a project just this last semester, and I love her description of it. She said, literally, she said, I'm not exaggerating when I say that my husband morphed into an excited schoolboy right in front of my eyes. The boyish grin on his face told me that everything was worth the effort and that he truly felt loved and welcomed in his home, because she'd gone to the trouble to try to prepare things that would make him feel welcomed and wanted and loved.
You know, I appreciate so much the way you present that. And, you know, I've been the beneficiary of that for so many years, mom and grandmothers. And, you know, when I think about my grandmothers, one of the most, I guess, primary things I think about, one of the first things that comes to my mind is how they cooked. I mean, because they were doing that a lot of the time, by the way. You
they
know, an
were.
Awful lot of their day was in the kitchen. And, you know, I remember sitting down the meals, and, you know, I was always looking forward to those meals. My mom, by the way, you mentioned her. She used to get frustrated with me when I was a teenager. I was the eldest, and she got frustrated with me because I asked her probably too many points in the day, what are we going to have for supper? What are we going to have for dinner?
Your son does that every day.
Yeah. I think anyone who has a teenage son knows that question's coming. And I remember when I went off to college, she wrote me in a note one time. She said, I miss you asking every day what's for dinner. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that
sweet.
Touched my heartstrings. But it is something that comes down to the fact that that's where we live.
That is. And I have to give my mother credit on the pie crust issue, too, because she made wonderful pie crust, still does at age 85. And I've passed it on to Katie. And Katie surprised me on my birthday just this summer. She was home and made me a homemade cherry pie from scratch, had it all ready when I get up on my birthday morning, and did that all by herself. What an act of love that was. And it's not, again, just about the food. It's the memories. It's all that evokes. And so,
and they're funny. Blessing. They're funny little things that are family things. For instance, when I eat at your mother's table, and she's a wonderful cook, and I see, for instance, even how she like peels a cucumber, I go, I recognize those cucumbers. There are family traditions and things that get passed down generation to generation. And when that's lost, folks, there's just an awful lot that is lost. This isn't the most important topic in the world. This is not the most urgent moral issue in the world. But when you consider what it means for a Christian home, this is where we are every single day. We'll be right back. Welcome back. One of my greatest challenges in this radio program is getting my wife to join me on it. And she agreed because the issue was cooking. Thanks for coming, Mary.
Well, you know, the downside for you is, honey, is I'm over here instead of cooking dinner, so you're going to have to take me out tonight.
Well,
one thing.
There you go.
But also, I am definitely the only guest who gets to say that I am your most faithful listener and your biggest fan, both of those. So
that's
thank
awfully
you.
Sweet. Now, you had a couple of closing thoughts. I just want you to share those.
Well, I did kind of say that it's not all about the food, and I want to go back to that a little bit and say, you know, if you do enjoy this subject, you know, do it with gusto. You know, when you see the movie, if you see it, you know, there are people that will really resonate with. And so I say just go with that. Develop signature dishes that are your own. You know, make your own salad dressings. Do things that are a little bit out of the ordinary if you wish. If you don't love it, that's okay too. You know, you may have gifts in other areas that you want to pursue, but you know, we are called to be women who are biblically challenged to watch well over the ways of our household. And so we don't have the option to just say, I don't cook, I don't care, I'm not going to learn to. You've got a family that the Lord has given you, and it's your responsibility to provide meals for them that will be enjoyable, and they don't have to be, you know, gourmet.
Are we going to lose all this?
It's possible. I mean, the skeptics out there say they will. The quote from the article that's up on your website, the skeptic there says that cooking will be something that our grandchildren will only hear about as something that people did because they had no other choice. What a sad day that would be.
It is. Katie, I just want to ask you real quickly. Do you think the young women of your generation are one day all of a sudden going to say, boy, I want to recover this? There are all kinds of things going on right now with recovering lost wisdom. How about this one?
I think there's a real hope in that. I think that sort of like there's a maternal instinct. I feel like there's kind of a desire for these girls to learn how to cook, and they want to be able to watch well over the ways of their household, and just as lots of vintage things are coming back, I think maybe we will hopefully rediscover the art of cooking.
I've had so many heartwarming replies, some challenging ones as well, but a lot of letters have come in, folks saying, I really celebrate this. Thank you for writing the article, because this is something that is so important to our family. I've had several who've written in and said, I really want to think this through, because I realize something there is being lost. You know, one of the points that I've heard you make, Mary, in your hospitality lectures is that boys are watching, and that they really need also to be looking for what they should be looking for in a wife. And I remember you saying one time that not being able to cook isn't necessarily a deal maker. I got to tell you, from an awful lot of young men's perspectives, I think it's more of a deal breaker than you may think.
Could be.
Folks, we're always glad to hear from you. But I got one sweet thing that came just here in the last few seconds by Twitter. Someone tweeted to say, I just made meatloaf, buttermilk biscuits, and chess squares for my siblings. I find they like me better because of it. Well, I don't know about liking you, but I'll tell you what, they know you love them when you do that. Lost wisdom, it can be recovered. And for the Christian family, it's always not just about food, but about a whole lot more. Back next week for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.